From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. It was variously called a noble experiment and the worst legislative mistake this country ever made. It was prohibition, the constitutional ban on producing and selling beer, wine, and liquor. It failed flamboyantly and spectacularly, and nowhere more so than in New York City. Michael Lerner writes about prohibition in New York in a new book called Dry Manhattan. In Lerner's view, the advocates of prohibition weren't just opposed to alcohol and drunkenness, they were also opposed to a new American urban culture of diverse immigrant groups. Those immigrants dominated the population of New York City, and they typically opposed prohibition.
They almost universally were against it. Jews, Irish Catholics, Eastern European immigrants, Italians, Southern Europeans, Greeks, Puerto Ricans, Spaniards, you can just go down the list, Scandinavians. The earlier groups, the Germans, almost all of them had some sort of cultural connection to alcohol. It was just seen as something that was part of everyday life in some capacity. They all had their traditional drinks and their traditional drinking practices.
And in the case of the Irish and the Democratic Party of Manhattan, there was a strong connection between politics and the saloon.
Definitely. The saloon was sort of the headquarters for most political organizations, and a great number of New York City politicians came up through the world of saloons. It was a great place to dole out favors and a great place to rally people. So it really did translate into a source of political power for Democrats in New York. Tammany Hall was the organization that basically ran the city then.
And in the political terms of the day, it was wet. It was anti-prohibition.
Very wet. Sopping wet.
You describe prohibition as a policy that was flagrantly violated by New Yorkers of various classes. How wet was New York during the years of prohibition?
Well, no one knows how many speakeasies there were. The estimates go as high as 32,000, which was far more than the number of bars. Any person that you could come across really had their own way of violating the law. People wanted the drinking culture that had existed in New York for a century, and they weren't going to give it up. So New York was pretty wet. I mean, I think people who live in New York today know the proliferation of Chinese restaurant takeout menus that come under the door.
Mm-hmm.
You had the same thing with liquor menus. People would just slide them under your door, listing everything they had for sale, home delivery. It really was as easy as picking up the phone and calling and saying, send me a case. So people were drinking. There's no doubt about that, and they were drinking on all levels of society. What's unfortunate is the way it was enforced. People went after the working class, and they left the rich alone. And, I mean, sometimes some people say you can see parallels in the way drug policy is enforced today.
Both the passage of the constitutional amendment that prohibited alcohol and ultimately its repeal, the way you relate these stories, the stories carry an interesting lesson that very often different events and different causes combine in unpredictable ways to produce a result. First, we have the story of New York City, full of immigrant groups, the United States just entering the First World War, and World War I, as you describe it. That fact is what puts prohibition over the top.
Yeah, if you could tie the issue of alcohol to patriotism and to the war effort, which is what the dry lobby did, by saying things like you shouldn't be wasting grain for alcohol when there's a war going on. You shouldn't be serving troops in uniform. That anyone who drinks is somehow threatening the security of the nation. When you say that over and over enough, it has an impact. The other thing that really helped is the United States was at war with Germany. And Germans in New York were some of the biggest opponents of prohibition. The brewing industry was a German-dominated industry, and the German names are still all out there, Budweiser, Miller. And you could just shut down the Germans. They were not going to dare say that they were against prohibition in a wartime climate. So it really silenced a lot of the opposition. The Irish are a similar case. Irish Americans had no great fondness for Britain. But when the United States gets into it with Britain as an ally, the Irish Americans suddenly found that if prohibition was going to be a wartime issue, they weren't going to be able to say a whole lot against it.
So here we have a national policy put over the top in part by the odd coincidence of the First World War, nurtured with American nativism and mistrust of minority groups who predominated in New York City. And then we flash forward to 1932, the U.S. is in the Depression. The market crashed a couple of years earlier. Franklin Delano Roosevelt is the Democratic candidate for president. And it's unclear to many people whether he is more the economic reformer or simply the wet candidate for president.
Right. Well, the two issues really became fused, and they became fused because they were a test of political leadership. Americans were looking for a president who would listen to them. Herbert Hoover really bungled his handling of prohibition. And at this point, it had gone on so long and was so clearly not working, in American cities at least, that people could look at him and say, this guy just doesn't get it. Roosevelt had a very strange path to becoming the wet candidate. I mean, people initially were not sure that he was the right person. There was a lot of enthusiasm for repeal in 1932, but people weren't quite so sure who would be the person to take the country in that direction. And Roosevelt had to win a lot of people over. Once he did, though, it became clear that both in terms of prohibition and in terms of the Depression, he was listening to people. He didn't have all the answers yet, but he was listening.
In the end, you conclude that the lesson is one about the relationship between the majority and minorities, the relationship between the government and a single vision of morality, and really a much more honest, authentic relationship between the people and the government.
Yes. Prohibition really puts to test the idea of how far government can go in terms of reforming people. Prohibition was not, even though this was done according to the books and through the constitutional process, this was not something that was really done democratically. This was more done through lobbying than through a genuine expression of democratic will. So it really does bring into question how quickly you should move on reform issues, and also this whole thing about listening to the people. When a reform is not going the way it's intended to go, you have to be flexible. You have to be able to look at the situation and say this needs to be rethought. And putting something in the Constitution does not give you that flexibility. So it's a cautionary tale in that regard.
Michael Lerner, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Michael Lerner is the author of the new book, Dry Manhattan, Prohibition in New York City.